Hello and welcome to the Psych Files, what psychology is really all about. Michael Britt here, host of the Psych Files, and I've got a really interesting interview for you this episode, episode 166. It's been a busy fall, and so I haven't released an episode in a little bit. I've been really busy working on the next couple of apps for the Psych Files, a program that I call the Psych Test Hero. And it's out there now for the iPad, but I'll tell you more about that later. One of the things I've been doing this fall, though, is reading a really fascinating book. It's called The Secret Life of Pronouns. Now, if you're into language, and I don't know, I've always been fascinated by language, and if you're interested in it as well, I think you would enjoy this book. This is about how we reveal parts of ourselves, our personalities, our emotions, in the tiniest words that we use. Pronouns and adjectives and adverbs and all kinds of what Dr. Pennebaker, author of the book The Secret Life of Pronouns, refers to as function words. They're the little words that connect the bigger ones. You know, we usually think that the way to figure out if someone is happy or sad is, of course, to look for those words. I'm happy, I'm sad, right? And he calls those the content words. But what do you reveal in the smaller words? Now, you might think, well, you know, I suppose narcissists use the word I. Yeah, there's a little bit of that, but what about words like we and even the? You know, can you reveal, you know, parts of your personality in the way that you use these small words? Well, you would be surprised. I was. One of the things you might see a lot online is an assessment of a country's emotional state through the analysis of the tweets that come out of it. And they're often looking at content words. What do people say? What kind of emoticons do they use? Do they say that they're happy, etc.? And Dr. Pennebaker looks at the content of tweets, but again, he's looking at a totally different part of the language. So he looks at emails, any kind of written text, even poems. What do they reveal about the author's personality? Wouldn't it be interesting for you to look at some of what you might consider to be the most mundane emails that you write every day? Analyze them to see what did they say about you or other people. And he has a neat program online available for free use called Luke, L-I-W-C, which will do just that. So if you're looking for a link to that program, it's online. Very fascinating researcher. Dr. Pennebaker is currently the chair of the psychology department at the University of Texas. But if you go to his website, and there's links from my website to his, you'll find that he's got all kinds of neat tools online, personality assessment tools, some of the familiar ones, such as the Big Five personality test. But there's also some neat ones on there you might not have seen, such as the Buddha Survey. He's done some really fascinating research over the years, along with his graduate students. And among the courses he teaches, of course, introductory psychology. He teaches a course in language and personality, psychology and language. This is the guy. Oh, yes, the other thing that people are often looking at is how can you tell when someone's lying, right? And a lot of people have been looking at micro expressions on our faces. But what about the words that you use and how you use those really tiny words? Really good stuff. Without further ado, let's listen to what he has to say about his work over the years on the secret life of these tiny little words.
Let's jump into it then. Got a great title here, The Secret Life of Pronouns. Right in the beginning, you make a very important observation, which is that when we're trying to figure out what people might be thinking or feeling, we focus on the content words. But the whole focus of your research has been on what you refer to as the function words. So why don't you just start off by telling our audience what you mean by that? What are those words?
Well, very broadly, we can break language into two classes of words, content and function. And content words are the words we all pay attention to. These are nouns, words like table, cloud, etc., or regular verbs, run, sing, etc., and also some adjectives, blue, happy, and a few adverbs. And then what's left over are these little words that we don't pay much attention to. They're the smallest words in our vocabulary. They're words like pronouns, I, me, you, he, she, or prepositions, to, for, of, or negations, no, not, never, auxiliary verbs, am, is, was.
Articles.
Articles, a, and the, a few others. In English, most of us have a vocabulary of somewhere between 50 and 100,000 words, and only about 500 of those are these function words, so they account for a very, very small percentage of our vocabulary. Nevertheless, they account for probably close to 60% of all the words we say, all the words we hear, we read. It's these words that are kind of the fillers. They're the words that are in between these content words. And what's interesting about them is they are processed in the brain differently, and that they're very, very social. Another way that you can see these function words in action is, imagine you, the wind's blowing and a piece of paper comes down the street, you pick it up and the piece of paper says, I'll be here later, wait for me. Well, on a certain level that makes sense, but then on another level it makes absolutely no sense. Almost all of those words are function words. And the reason it doesn't make any sense is we don't know who the other person is. We don't know anything about the context of that note. So, I'll be here later. I'll. Who is I? Will. Will implies future tense. When was it written? Be here. Where's here? When's later? Wait for me, etc. Now, all of those words, except perhaps wait, are function words. And they're shared, their meaning is shared between the speaker and the listener at a particular point in time. So all of a sudden these words, these function words, are stand-ins for content. And what this means is if we start to analyze function words, the way that we different people use them, we start to get inside their heads. We get a sense of who they are, how they're connecting with others, kind of their social relationships. Let's look at words like he, she, they, you, we. Now, if I have two, let's say, emails, and one has lots of pronouns and the other doesn't, can we pick up anything about the writer when we do that? And the answer is yes. The person who is making references to pronouns, he, she, they, etc., is by very definition interested in other people. They have mentioned another person, and now they have mentioned them at least once or twice again. And from this, we can get a sense of a person's social orientation. So what this starts to mean is, as we start to analyze language, we get a sense of the person and their relations with others. It's also interesting, there are certain mental disorders, such as schizophrenia. One of the hallmarks of that is errors in pronouns, in that they assume that the person they're talking to has knowledge of what's going on in their own brain, and so that, or their own recent experience. So they might talk about the person who was in the room. When you've just walked in, you have no idea who they're referring to. They've lost this ability to remember who they've told what to or what was there versus not.
So they've lost the ability to know what it is I know and don't know?
That's right. That's right.
That's the kind of theory of mind?
Kind of a failure in their theory of mind.
So that's why they talk about things that to me don't make any sense, but to them do.
That's right. And if you were inside their head, they would probably make a lot of sense.
Now, are you the first person to look at these subtle differences?
Well, people have been talking about this in linguistics and other areas for generations. The difference is those people are really interested in language. And the irony is I'm really not that interested in language. I'm more interested in the psychology of people. Companies like Google and others provide us for the first time this window of link between the way people are using words and their behaviors. Now, they've been focusing a lot on buying behaviors, but it's still the same idea of how do these words predict how you search terms when you're trying to find information about a product or whatever.
Mm-hmm. And you know, one of the surprising things that, I mean, people dismissed Twitter for so long, and then finally gained a little bit of respect when people stopped talking about, well, most people stopped talking about what they're having for breakfast. But now I've seen these, so like, you know, these graphics, and now people are looking, but they're looking at the content words. They're like, talking about the emotional state of a country based upon an analysis of the tweets, you know, sounds a little, maybe a little far-fetched, but on the other hand, it's like, okay, you know, lots of people are tweeting about how happy they are, but they're looking at content words, and you do a little bit of this on one of your sites. It's called
AnalyzeWords.com.
Yes. So are you doing the same thing as they're doing? You're looking at emotional states. But how are emotional states revealed in words like the and
Well, think about what emotions are. Emotions are generally reflect some kind of action tendency. So if I'm angry, what goes with that is I am going to attack you or am certainly motivated in that direction. If I'm sad and hurt and depressed, I'm going to curl up in a corner and try to get away, and I'll be licking my wounds, paying attention to myself. If you start thinking about emotional states that way, they imply other kinds of words. If I'm angry at you specifically, I'm going to use words like you, and I might use words like he, she as well. My senses are going to be shorter, but I'm not going to be self-reflective. I'm not going to be saying, I feel a little upset. I'm going to say, you're dead to me or whatever. If I'm depressed, I am self-focused. I'm going to say the word I all the time. I feel this, and I'm hurt, and the pain I'm experiencing is so blah, 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 blah. And if I'm happy, I'm not going to be self-focused. I'm going to be talking about, the world is beautiful today. We need to go do so-and-so. I'll use words like we at much higher rates. We can see signs of these emotional states by other words beyond emotions. My students and I have actually done some research on how people talk immediately after a traumatic death. And one thing that happens, for example, after September 11th, there's a drop in the use of I. There's an increase in the use of the word we. They're also reaching out to others. When there's a tragedy, people become much more socially connected, and they start using we more, and they talk about their family, their friends, those who are close to them.
So have you tried to do what others are doing, analyzing tweets at this broad level, looking instead at function words instead of the content words?
We have. In fact, we've got, I'm working with a group of people who've been doing work with tweets with Jeff Hancock, Art Grazer, and David Beaver, as well as my colleague here, Cindy Chung. And we've been analyzing tweets.
You've got the powerful computers and so much communication going on with, with tweets and audio and video. I mean, look at all that there is on YouTube that could be analyzed if the words were extracted. Do you envision, because I know in one of your chapters you talk about, everybody's interested in personality, and so you've even tried to extract some personality characteristics by analyzing the words that people use.
The nature of personality in psychology has been built pretty much around questionnaires. Certainly in Western society, that's what we tend to do. So probably the most standard strategy now is this five-factor model. So there's openness, extroversion, and so forth. Well, another way to think about this is, how can we think about language? Because it turns out that people are reasonably consistent in the way they use words. So, for example, some people use pronouns at high rates and others don't. Some use articles at high rates or prepositions, etc. People who are using high rates of nouns and articles, comparing those with people who tend to use high rates of pronouns and verbs. Now, that sounds really boring.
Yeah, kind of. It's like, oh, my God. I don't want to take that class.
I know. I would have been horrified. Someone told me I'd be talking about this with enthusiasm years ago. But it's almost a continuum. And what it's really capturing is the distinction between categorical thinking. In other words, people who tend to think in categories. Versus the other end of the continuum are storytellers. It's a more narrative style. they're pretty consistent. Generally, people who are more narrative tend to be female. They tend to be more socially engaged and more socially skilled. People who are more categorical, those people who use articles and nouns at high rate, they like structure in their life. They tend to be more conscientious. They tend to be more conservative. And you can start to get a sense of how people are thinking and how they're approaching the world by the way they're using these parts of speech.
Okay. I'm starting to kind of make some sense to me. The people who like structure speak very differently than people who are a little more free-flowing and, as you say, narrative. But you're saying that also correlates even with some of their political beliefs, that you can extend that to other parts of their lives.
That's right. And that's what's most fun about this, and a little bit creepy. I mean, let's not kid ourselves, that by getting a speech sample, you start to be able to peg people. People who are young speak differently than people who are old. Upper middle class speak differently than people who are lower middle class. Men are different from women. Depressed versus not depressed. All of these dimensions have their own fingerprint. This linguistic fingerprint is also telling us how they're paying attention to their world, how they're thinking about it.
Okay, well, let's finish up on gender differences, always a topic of interest. And I don't know that your book upended anything, because you were saying that, well, women, and I'll let you summarize it then. What are you finding? What's the difference between men and women?
Let's start off with what people think. Who uses the following words more, men or women? The word I, the word we, the use of articles, use of emotion words, use of cognitive words like because, cause, effect, reason, rationale, social words, he, she, they. Okay, the average group that I talk to says, well, it's obvious, men use I more. Oh, it's obvious, women use we more. Articles, well, we're not sure, but we're pretty sure women use articles more. Emotion words, everybody knows women use those more. Cognitive words, obviously men. And social words, obviously women. And that's what most people I speak to say and think. And they're all wrong except for social words. So, in fact, women use social words more than men do. Hooray. So, but these other findings, some of them are huge and some of them are not. One that's huge is I. Women use the word I at much higher rates than do men. And by the way, I'm not saying this is true with all men and all women, because even within sex, you have some high users and some low users. Pronouns are used and they tell us where people are paying attention. If a person is using the word I, they're being self-focused. They're paying attention to their thoughts, their feelings. They're more self-reflective. But our culture thinks that I is a marker of narcissism, a marker of being confident, arrogant, self-centered in that way. And it's not. People use I when they are being more vulnerable, more self-attentive, if you like, self-aware. We, us, and our. People think that we, just as we had in our conversation, is this warm and fuzzy we. In fact, there's absolutely no difference between men and women in their use of we. Emotion words. Turns out men and women use emotion words at just about the same rate, so just no difference.
But do women use different sorts of emotion words than men? Do men use more anger words?
Yes, and there is a slight tendency for men to use anger words more than women, and women tend to use sadness words more than men. But the effects are pretty small. That's the one thing they come away from. These are not big effects. Cognitive words, because, cause, effect, reason, rationale, women use those at much higher rates. And articles, A, N, and E, men use those at much, much higher rates than women.
So men, like the dog or the engine, they're always referring to things outside of themselves.
So it's the dog, a dog. And when we use articles, we use those in front of nouns, specifically concrete nouns, specifically things that you could almost put your hands on. Women are using these social words more. In general, women tend to talk more about other human beings. They're interested in people. Men talk more, in general, about concrete objects and things. Carburetors, telephones, computers, iPhones. And this brings us to these cognitive words. I said that women use cognitive words more because cause, effect, reason, rationale. The reason is that human beings are much more complex than our carburetors. And if you try to come up with an analysis of why somebody did something versus why the carburetor is not working, it requires a far more sophisticated and complex argument to understand why Joe is having an affair with Julie when everybody knows Julie is really a lot better than da-da-da-da-da-da.
Interesting. There's like this whole world below what's on the surface. It sounds somewhat Freudian, actually.
I think it is. And, you know, that's why I love the title, Secret Life of Pronouns, in that we're dealing here with this, the fact that these function words are kind of below the radar. We don't pay attention to them. Our brains are not wired to hear them. So, for example, here we've been talking, and you don't know if I've been using pronouns at higher or lower rates than most people. I don't. And I have no idea about you. First of all, anyone who ever talks to me, you don't need to worry because I can't hear these things. I need a computer to analyze it. So, for example, I can do a pretty darn good job at telling if someone's depressed or not depressed in natural conversation by the way they use I. I'm far from perfect, but certainly much better than chance. But I need to analyze the data. A depressed person uses the word I at much higher rates than someone who's not depressed. But when I say much higher rates, I words in depressed people might be, I'm pulling these numbers out of my hat. Depressed people will probably use 7% of their words will be I, and non-depressed people it'll be more like 5%. Now, that difference from a statistical perspective is gigantic, it's huge. However, that difference is just imperceptible to the brain. We just can't hear it.
All right, well, let's wind up with the story of GH. Interesting story. If you tell us that, I think an audience would find it interesting, too.
Okay. My students and I, were doing these projects on sex differences. And I got an email from an old friend of mine, Jim Dabbs, who is now dead, but he was just a wonderfully creative researcher at Georgia State who has been doing work on testosterone for years. And he had received this email from a person by the name of G.H. G.H. was a biological female, but she never felt comfortable in the role of being a female. And so she became transgendered and became a he. He now was taking testosterone injections once every 3 weeks or so and had kept a diary for a long time. He had sent an email to Dabbs asking, could he be in an experiment? Would Dabbs be interested in him? And so Dabbs sent me this GH's email, and I emailed GH and said, well, I'm doing research on diaries, and I'm interested in his length of testosterone. Have you kept your records of when you took shots? And do you date your diaries? And would you let me analyze your diaries? And he did. He sent me 2 years of diaries along with when he had had injections. We started analyzing the data from that. And about the same time, I was at a conference, and I was sitting at a bar with a friend and telling him about this research. And this guy said, well, you know, that's interesting. I've been taking testosterone myself for the last few years because I need it for upper body strength. He worked on a farm. And I said, wow, do you keep records of your testosterone? And he didn't keep a diary, but he would let me analyze all his emails, which I Here we have a biological male and a biological female both taking testosterone, and we have language samples. And I was interested in what changed in terms of their language. Now, the intuition of GH, the female-to-male or transgendered person, was that he was more aggressive, higher self-esteem, less depressed, more interested in sports after he took his testosterone injections. The other guy that I met at the bar, he said it had absolutely no effect. Well, interestingly for both of them, it did have an effect, and it didn't go along with what either of them thought. And the primary issue was the degree to which they made reference to other people. And these would be pronouns like he, she, they, we, you, In other words, all non-self pronouns. And what happens is people would take these, their injection of testosterone, and all of a sudden their interest in other human beings would just drop. And then as their testosterone levels started to drop over the next 3 weeks, they started making more references to other people, almost as they were kind of waking up, looking around, saying, wow, look at all these people around me. And then they talk about he, she, they, and then they get their next shot injection, and they were cured. They didn't have to pay.
Oh, boy, I'll bet you women would like the results of this study.
Yeah. Well, you know, it kind of explains a lot.
It does. Now, so, you know, that's two people. Are you going to be following up on this?
No, I'm not.
It's a hard thing to study.
Guy. If somebody wants to follow up on it, I encourage them to do so.
I'll bet. You could take this research in quite a number of directions, and it's good to hear that you've got a number of grad students who are doing that.
I do. I'm very fortunate to have such a good group.
Well, listen, I congratulate you on a really interesting book, and so I'll tell my audience about this. I think it's a fascinating read. You know, for something that's right there in front of you every day, but you just don't pay any attention to it. Really neat. Really neat. I know it's hard to put together a book. I'm glad you took the time to do that.
Well, thank you. I'm glad you like it.
Convey my congratulations to your grad students, too.
I will.
All right, Jim. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time. It's been a fun conversation.
You bet.
All right. Pretty cool, huh? Pretty interesting stuff. Drop by the bookstore, pick up something interesting, check it out. It's called The Secret Life of Pronouns, James Pennebaker. So as I mentioned at the beginning, I've been busy this fall working on a mobile app called Psych Test Hero. It's for students who are preparing for, just about any psychology test, including the AP Psych exam or the GRE. Yeah, check it out. It's available now as an iPad app, and I've been working really, really hard to convert it into both an iPhone and an Android app. So I've been having fun with that. So more information on that coming up in the next episode of the Psych Files in 2012. Okay, again, thanks for joining us. Hope you enjoyed this, and see you next time. Take care.